Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, March 1st. Happy March. Rabbit, everybody. 2017, and I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. And today I'm going to be opening public hearings on House Bill 5026 and House Bill 5027. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, today we start the presentation on public health, and it will go today and tomorrow. You notice there's two bills. The second bill, House Bill 5027, is what we call the fee ratification bill. And so I wanted to give you just a little context. Long ago, there was a law passed that said if an agency administratively either established or increased a fee, then in the next legislative session, they would come in and get that approved. And so that's what that's going to be. There's just a couple things. Typically, with now that we have annual sessions, typically what we see are fees that are established by a new bill, and so the agency obviously is going to be establishing something, but they still do come back and get that ratified. The other thing, and they aren't actually going to talk about that until tomorrow. The other thing I wanted to remind you is that tomorrow we meet in Hearing Room E, and I will email you one more time, but apparently there is a big, hairy public hearing in this room, so you'll know right away it's the wrong place.
Okay. Takes the pressure.
Hearing Room E tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Floor is yours, ladies.
Thank you. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, I'm Lynn Saxton. I'm the Director of the Oregon Health Authority, and today is our Ways and Means presentation on our Public Health Division. Just a couple quick points I want to underline before I turn it over to Lillian Shirley and Dr. Hedberg. The Public Health Division in Oregon is in the Oregon Health Authority, along with the Medicaid health work and behavioral health, of course, and the state hospital. That is not the norm across the country and gives us an opportunity to leverage investments for population health, which is what public health focuses on, the 4 million Oregonians, and Medicaid health, which is the give or take 1 million Oregonians on Medicaid services. And that is something that we are the envy of many states because we can do that cross-checking, cross-comparing. We can look at investments we're making in public health that pay dividends in Medicaid health at the CCOs, so we don't duplicate and replicate. So I think we have worked intensely over the last 2 years to take advantage of that unique structure and opportunity. We have more work to do in that place, but it is something that makes Oregon's health system distinct. Secondly, I'd like to just point out that public health has been in a process of assessing baseline assessment for modernizing Oregon's public health system, which we're very excited about. Those foundational assessments are complete, and our team can go into more detail on that for you. But it is the beginning of looking at public health in a 21st century manner and developing the resources across the state and allocating the resources more correctly that communities need to be ready for what is an increasingly complex public health environment. In the last biennium, we've managed Zika, Ebola, and two public health crises, both in Harney County and Douglas County, resulting from community events that required large deployments of behavioral health specialists and public health teams to ensure that communities could continue to exercise their daily work and their daily lives. So I'll just stop there as introduction and introduce Lillian Shirley, who is our Director of Public Health.
Thank you, Lynn. Senator Steiner-Hedwig, Representative Rayfield, it's a privilege to have this opportunity to talk about the Public Health Division to you and our budget. Well, we're going to structure it so that the first part is kind of what
Could
we do.
Could you introduce yourself for the
record? Oh, I'm Lillian Shirley. I'm the Public Health Director in the Oregon Health Authority. And I have with me today.
So, good morning, co-chairs Steiner-Hayward and Rayfield, and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg. I am the state health officer with the Public Health Division.
Thank you.
My apologies.
No, it's fine.
So, so today, as I said, first we're going to go through kind of what we do and a little bit of how we do it, and then we'll go into how it's funded and paid for. First, we're just going to review examples of our work that is underway and that we've begun in the last year. Our mission is to promote health and prevent the leading causes of death, injury, and disease in Oregon. And to do that, we've identified goals for a modern public health system. And I'm going to just walk through some of the examples of what we mean by these bullet points: to protect people from communicable diseases, prepare and respond to emergency. So one example under the first goal is healthcare acquired infections, which is really has become, over the last 20 years, increasingly identified as a major issue and threat to the public's health across the country. And Oregon was privileged to be one of the earliest states to implement and look at ways to track this and to work with the healthcare and provider community, both in physicians' office as well as hospitals, to address that. And one major action has been the institution of a statewide surveillance system and a response network working with our providers. And a result that we've seen is that one of the major hospital-acquired infections is known as, well, we'll just call it CPCRE. It's, the Latin name's a little hard. I can get Katrina to say it. But so far, even though we've had endemic and experiencing increasing transition in all the states around us, that we are not seeing that here in Oregon because of our ability to rapidly respond and work with our healthcare providers. Preparing for and responding to emergencies. This year we participated in the Cascade earthquake exercise, and this was led by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and Health and Human Services, all of whom who were on the ground here in Oregon. And we simulated this field response if indeed we had a subduction zone earthquake of a magnitude of 9.0. And this identified key strengths and opportunities for us in public health to work better with our partners and to identify ways that we can deploy resources to the most vulnerable areas of the state in the event of any significant national disaster. Director Saxton did talk about our response to the Umpqua Community College events. We coordinated both local, state, and federal partners in the public health space to stand up the Umpqua Wellness Center. And just yesterday I was talking to Representative Hayden and want to thank you for your support of all the work that we did on the ground there in Douglas County. Limiting environmental risk to public health, as you all are aware, we've launched as of January 21st,
Ms. Shirley?
Last 2016,
Ms.
we've been engaged.
I'm sorry, oh. Senator Gill.
Sorry.
Thank you. I just wanted to take a second to thank you for the work after Umpqua. I had the chance to be traveling with Lynn at that time around our mental health town hall, so got a chance to kind of see all of the work that was really happening behind the scenes from the health authority. And what I was really impressed by, and I think hasn't been talked a lot about, is when there is a crisis in a community, how important it is to be not only provide the resources, but to be respectful of the needs of that community and let the community be the driver of what is going on, rather than having people from the outside just kind of swoop in and take over. So I just really wanted to compliment Director Saxton's leadership, especially everything from checking in with local elected officials and college leaders and really being thoughtful about the deployment of staff and not taking up hotel space in the area. I mean, those were little things that are actually really, really big things. It gave me a lot of confidence in the health authority and Director Saxton's leadership, and I don't know that you've been publicly thanked for that work, that coordination, and the respect for the community, and I wanted to recognize you for that.
Co-Chair Senator Gelser, first, thank you for that support. I do want to say that the hero from the public health department was actually a really amazing public servant named Akiko Sato, who works in our public health division and moved to Roseburg and lived in Roseburg for, I think, 3 or 4 months. So she's the real hero here, and I just get to work with her. So
okay, thank you. So Cleaner Air Oregon has been something that we've been involved with since January of 2016, and it was really the Public Health Division working in a really new and innovative way and collaborative way with the Department of Environmental Quality. We are jointly developing the proposed state rules for adoption, and we'll consider populations at high risk for adverse impacts for harmful emissions, including the elderly and children and people with low incomes, and recognize that employment is also a key social determinant of health. So really coming together to develop a consensus around how we can work with the approximately 1,300 facilities around the state. Promoting health and countering the health harmful impact of chronic diseases and injuries. One of our major events that we've been able to work with people across sectors and across the state has been our opioid task force. The Public Health Division received funding from the Centers for Disease Control to develop and implement a comprehensive approach to reducing opioid overdose. We led and the OHA launched an agency-wide opioid initiative, which led to a statewide initiative with key partners, including the Oregon Medical Association, Health and Hospitals Association, and there's a few people that are on the committee that actually participated and really helped shape that. We ensure access to quality health care, and we don't do this in the same way that our partners in the private sector or the clinical sector do, but we work around bringing consensus to taking the prevalence of disease and bad outcomes away from making it possible to not have to serve people in clinical settings. So one of the examples is in December 1st, we launched, on World AIDS Day, we launched End HIV in Oregon initiative, and we're focusing on how to really get a handle on making sure that there are no domestic transmission of HIV in our state. And we're a state that has the resources to do that, and we have the cooperation across all sectors. So an example of the three areas that we're focusing on. The most important one is to increase HIV testing across the state, as well as to make sure that there's pre-exposure prophylaxis for those that are most at risk, while we're improving the rates of viral suppression through linkage with people who are already infected with good care and effective treatments.
Ms. Shirley, just a really quick question. Have we had any maternal child transmission in Oregon?
Of HIV in the last year?
Senator Syra Herod, to my knowledge, we have not, but we can find that out for you. I think we, again, the epidemic here, we have not seen a lot of cases in women and that transmission, but I can't say for sure we haven't, or whether there have been some women who've been HIV infected who've moved to the state and then have had a child here. Okay. So we will find you
the data. Thank you. It's one of the obvious places, because we certainly hope all women are getting prenatal care. So, and we know we can do.
Yeah, so I guess, Senator Syraird, so your question is both about women who are HIV infected giving birth and whether or not they were transmitted, or whether that the child was given prophylaxis so that the infection did not spread to them.
Yeah. Right. I mean, all of the above.
Yeah.
So. Thank you.
Correct. And we'll be talking. We do have some worrisome outcomes for children in another sexually transmitted disease that we'll talk about
a little bit later.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah. So another example of how we ensure equitable access to health care is we do a lot of work around policy and data analysis to let people understand what are the impacts of unintended pregnancy and work to prevent that. And last year, we calculate over 8,000 unintended pregnancies were prevented through the provision of very critical preventive reproductive health service and contraceptive methods to women in need in Oregon for those services.
So just as a heads up, I don't know whether you're planning to talk any more about CPAP or how you guys are doing that in the light of the fact that most women do now have, most but not all women, do have insurance coverage and should in theory be able to get contraception from their primary care provider. Are you planning to talk at all about that specific aspect at some point?
C-Care,
thank you.
Oh, C-Care, okay. C-Care,
sorry, I'm thinking about something else. I apologize. C-Care and you know, how you're coordinating with the CCS. I'm sorry. Too many different acronyms. My bad.
Don't laugh at me.
All right.
The short answer is yes.
Thank you.
What are you
talking about? So a little bit about us and our division. The public health division.
Sorry. I had to get my oxygen. No,
this is a very,
and the Rodney Dangerfield
really healthy to laugh. That's true.
Yeah, it's
great. Cool. Just good this morning.
Okay. So, co-chairs, what you have before you now is the Public Health Division organizational chart, and as Director Saxton identified, we are part of the larger OHA agency, and we are separated into five areas that have specific outcomes and measurement and accountability for the overall work that you will see in the Oregon Health Authority. Okay, so these are just a quick mosaic of some of the volume of results that we have from activity. Not health outcomes necessarily, but we thought it was important to get an idea of just the volume of work that is done. What we say about public health is it's like the River Platte, you know, it's an inch deep, you know, and over a mile wide. So it spans a tremendous amount of work that sometimes doesn't seem to be related to each other, but does all roll up into protecting and preventing disease for Oregonians. And we investigate and respond to disease
Sorry. No, it's not me. It's Senator Winters.
Okay.
could you give us the explanation of the 7 million newborn screenings and kind of break that out a little bit? Because I understand it's not 7 million children, but there's multiple kinds of screening. Could you help us?
Sure, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Hedberg.
So, I'm very conscious.
There's quite a long list of proven practices that you can test a newborn infant for that will help developmentally in getting them into the kind of care and that the screening identifies before it's too late.
Right. What I was after was that I didn't want individuals to think that there were 7 million newborns.
Right.
So, Co-Chair Senator Winters, you're absolutely right. Each year in Oregon, we have about 45,000 babies who are born. So our lab does testing, of course, of all of those. And as Ms. Shirley mentioned, those include numerous tests on each of those. Oregon is also a regional laboratory, so we do a number of newborn screening tests for other states as well. So, and that's actually a way that our public health lab is able to get some revenue dollars to help. So I think this is the total number to show you the capacity that's done, but that's some of the regional work for other states as well.
I, Madam Chair, I'd just like to remind that we have new individuals that are serving on this panel, so as much information as you could provide is kind of helpful.
Senator Gilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say the lab is also one of the best field trips that I've been on since coming to the legislature, though I was kind of freaked out by some of the parasites that I got to see in jars, and it made me very glad that there is a public health department to deal with the bats, the parasites, the worms, all of the things that now give me nightmares 2 years later after the field trip.
I still have them 30 years after taking parasitology in med school, so yes.
So co-chairs and Senator Gelser, yes, our laboratory, as I say, is both, it's now state-of-the-art, and there's also the very hazardous substances, and so they have kind of a clean room that they go in, etc. So we would encourage anyone who is interested, we could arrange to have a trip of our laboratory to see the range of things that that they're able to do.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Representative Alonso Leon.
Yes, Dr. Hepburn, can you tell me a little bit more about the prescription drug monitoring program, patient records provided?
Sure. Co-chairs and Representative Alonso Leon. So we have a prescription drug monitoring program in Oregon. It's very similar. I think now all states but one have such a program. And schedule substances at the time that they are dispensed from pharmacies get reported to that prescription drug monitoring program. The purpose of this is so that when a provider sees a patient, they can check the PDMP, as we fondly call it, and see whether or not that patient, what their prescription history is, not just from that provider, but it's obviously one that we're concerned about if there are some patients who might have gone to multiple emergency departments or, you know, as we also fondly say, doctor shopping in order to get prescriptions. So it's really seen as a tool. So these are records, again, these are not,
And it's voluntary.
No. So all of the records at the time the pharmacy dispenses those get loaded in, but it's up to the provider to check the PDMP, et cetera. Records, I think, are maintained for a maximum of 3 years. And then, so again, that's part of the Oregon system to check it. So this has to do with the number of records or prescriptions filled. We also have a report, and we can get you more data on that. But, of course, a number of patients will have had multiple prescriptions. So, for example, and it doesn't distinguish between what the disease is. So, for example, patients at the end of life might be getting lots of prescriptions, and we would expect that. So it doesn't distinguish the reason for those prescriptions. But again, if someone's coming into an emergency department, that provider would know whether or not the patient had a history of getting prescriptions elsewhere.
Follow up?
Yes. So this is for emergency facilities only?
No.
It's across the board, all doctors, mm-hmm. all pharmacists have this information. So then I guess this is also a protective if somebody's taking multiple medicines that could conflict with each other.
Yeah, so co-chairs and Representative Alonso Leon, the only medications, I would say only, but are the scheduled substances. So these are things like narcotics, benzodiazepines, or those kinds. So antibiotics are not included in this. So, and it is, again, everybody has access to it, and we really are trying to encourage, all providers, physician providers primarily, but there are others who prescribe as well, like nurse practitioners, just as an example, or dentists. We want to encourage everyone to be enrolled and to check this when they are seeing a patient, particularly for the first time, or for whom they are prescribing one of these scheduled substances. So again, not all medications, and what you just alluded to about drug interactions, that is beyond the scope of the PDMP. We would, of course, hope that both the providers and pharmacists would be working together to look at what the range of medications that any particular patient had received. So it's a it's a specific use, and again, it's the concern about controlled substances and at this point, high doses of opiates, for example.
Thank you.
Representative Bueller, and then Representative Hayden, and then Representative Malmstrom.
Representative, we're going to hear more about PDMP in the Healthcare Committee next week. Thank you for your good work on it. It's really helpful, and a lot of providers contact me regularly about how beneficial it is. One request that recently has come from the provider community is there a way to push out notifications from PDMPs? So, you know, if a lot of the PBMs now are making that designation to us with a mailing. Is that at all possible, or in the realm of possibility?
So, co-chairs and Representative Bueller. So I think there's two parts to that question, whether it is technically possible and whether the Oregon statute allows it. And I know you're very familiar with the Oregon statute. Currently, our PDMP does not allow for that kind of push information. Now, as you know, we're trying to make it more useful so that the PDMP, through this gateway network and electronic health records, can be checked so that people don't have to then log separately into the PDMP from an electronic health record. That's a little bit different than a push notification. So again, there's technical, and then there's my understanding of the current statute.
Okay, so let me just clarify. So according to statute, you can't push.
That is my understanding, is that when a patient comes in, the PDMP could not automatically say, alert, red flag, this patient. On the other hand, if it's an electronic record, for example, in the emergency department, when someone comes in as they're logging into that, the PDMP under the medical director of an emergency department could have that record checked. But for example, if someone comes into a clinic and they have that first, they wouldn't automatically get a push from the PDMP.
Technically, can you do it?
I am not an IT expert. We can look into that. My understanding is that other states do have an ability to do a push notification. So,
could you just get back to me on the
phone? Absolutely.
We can get back to you.
Yes.
We're doing some upgrades, actually, to the system based on the work that was done by the collaborative. So we can definitely look into that specifically.
So, yes, we can look at the technology, and then we will let you know if there are statutory changes that are necessary.
We can help with that.
Yes, we can. Okay. Hayden and then Wall Street.
Just to kind of a follow-up on the same thing, thank you, Co-Chair. As the PDMPs are used, my question about that is, do you have a feel for that program being used proactively by the prescriber versus being used retroactively after the prescription goes to the pharmacist for those practitioners that are not necessarily on, and I think Epic is part of your solution here, there's new hospital technology that some of the hospitals have recently gone through that training that has a lot more flexibility from a technical standpoint that can get pushed out. But that doesn't push past into other types of providers. You talked about dentists and nurse practitioners. And so I think there is kind of a on the grounds, okay, we're going to, you know, they kind of in the back of their mind, they identify this patient base and they know what the problem is. They have access to go look that up, but it's more of a feedback loop from the pharmacist. Is that the intent, or are we trying to get it more proactive for these kind of outlier providers, ones that aren't in the loop, so to speak?
Yes, so co-chairs and Representative Hayden, again, you make a very good point. The PDMP, the statute was initially, when it was first passed, was really a tool for providers to be able to check a patient who was coming in. Now, as I say, the PDMP is populated not at the time the prescription is written, but by the pharmacy at the time a prescription is filled. But it does currently rely on people. So, again, Director Shirley said voluntary. It's not voluntary that the prescriptions are in there, but checking the PDMP does rely. So what we've been working on is to look at those prescribers that we know, because within the system we know who are high prescribers, and making sure that they are at least registered in the PDMP. And I think one of the questions, and I know there are a number of bills around the PDMP, but for example, having registration in the PDMP part of licensure, or when you're getting license renewal, that would be an idea that at least people would be on the system. It's hard for us to, you know, figure out a system where they would be required to check it prior to writing a prescription. Again, that's a different or a broader scope. But at least the first step is making sure that everybody who is a prescriber is enrolled in the PDMP.
And I might take the liberty of pointing out two things. Since Dr. Hedberg and I both spoke at a conference together on this issue about a month ago. First of all, there are some states that do require prescribers to access their PDMP before writing a prescription for a scheduled substance, a controlled substance.
Oregon hasn't gone that route yet, but I think we need to keep in the back of our mind. Second of all, as Dr. Hedrick pointed out, by no means does every provider who writes these prescriptions have a have access, a login for the PDMP, and that's a problem. But the third thing is that 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we passed a bill to allow providers with logins to delegate authority two years ago, 2015, to medical assistants or dental hygienists or whatever in their offices so that they could access it prior to the provider seeing the patient or and whatever setup. And we are working hard to try to get more providers to take advantage of that authority. I mean, I know in our practice we use it a lot, and it's been very helpful. We're trying a bunch of different techniques to get people to use it more, especially the high-volume prescribers. Now, hospice docs, obviously, we're not going to worry about too much because they're prescribing appropriate amounts in appropriate contexts, but other docs, not so much, or dentists, for that matter. Representative Malmstrom.
Yes, on the part here about the family served by maternal, infant, and early childhood programs, have been served in probably all of them over my career. Can you describe for the committee exactly which programs we're talking about?
Sure. Okay, so most of these services, all these services are delivered at the local level in communities, whether they're by our local partners in public health or by not-for-profits. So these would be a combination of Babies First Home Visiting, which the committee, I'm sure, is aware of. The state has supported that, as in addition to our work in conjunction with the Medicaid division, where we have what we call targeted case management. And we also work very closely with identifying children and families and women who are in pregnancy with the early learning division to identify who are the highest risk across the state of Oregon. And our feeling is we are kind of agnostic about who delivers the service once the local community determines who is the most appropriate provider to do that. So it's a combination of money that we get through the federal government, through Health and Human Services, through the Medicaid program and the match dollars that come down from targeted case management, as well as support from the Oregon Legislature for some of the individual programs that are funded here.
Okay.
Paula? Mm-hmm. The Cocoon program, does that fit into here?
Yes, okay. It does. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
There's different brand names, and slightly different populations that that are identified who need certain kinds of services. So that's
okay. Thank you. And co-chairs, I would just add that Representative Malmstrom, that the work that we do in that space is now integrated with the Early Learning Division. Kate Wilcox from our team sits on the Early Learning Division again with an idea to integrating and reducing duplication and using funds correctly.
Right.
Thank you.
Cool. Keep going.
Okay.
We have a very engaged committee, I'm sure you realize by now, which is great.
This is excellent. We've talked a lot about our modern approach to public health, and the next slide just identifies the kinds of areas that really we feel that moving into with our CCOs, with our transformation, and with a lot of the other collaboration that we've talked about, like with our opioid work here, with the private and public sector coming together in Oregon, what are the kind of priorities for governmental public health in this environment? And what you see before you are the areas that have been identified in the foundational capabilities of public health that our public health advisory board and the assessments that we've done across the public health network of local and state programming are where we should really focus our efforts for the future. So our outcomes from population-based prevention strategies include our metrics on improving lifelong health of Oregonians, reduced demand for costly healthcare services. My tagline for public health is we're in the demand reduction business on the healthcare continuum and improve educational outcomes, including our work, which is multi-sector with the education to make sure that kids are ready to learn and to achieve higher graduation rates. Just a little background on, you know, how we got to where we are when you see all the programmatic areas. In Oregon, the Public Health Division Department was founded in 1903, and our history was responding to infectious diseases. And as different infectious diseases and interventions for those diseases were identified in the science community, we kind of came up with a new program to address it. And today, we know that new and old infectious diseases are a continuing threat. Director Saxton identified Ebola, meningitis. We've dealt with West Nile virus in the near term. We're seeing a rise in whooping cough and some tuberculosis, really resistant tuberculosis that requires a tremendous amount of individual effort, both on the county and on the ground with communities, as well as with our surveillance and our lab work identifying that. And flu, good old ordinary flu. We're experiencing one of the worst flu seasons we've had in a while here in Oregon as well. And our most vulnerable citizens for flu outbreaks are those in assisted living and nursing homes and the elderly in general. So we've tried to reach out to populations who are caring both for family members but also institutionally to understand the implications of flu in that population. Now, here we are in 2017, and since our epidemiology in 2015 looked at our assessments, we know that the greatest risk for Oregonians are chronic diseases and also injuries, unintentional injuries in our population. So tobacco use, obesity are large contributors to chronic disease, and while there's a lot of attention to management of the consequences of tobacco use and obesity in our partners in the clinical realm, our job is to kind of look at how do we, again, decrease the prevalence of those diseases so people don't have the results of the diseases that tobacco use and obesity contribute. And we've made significant progress through a lot of policy in particularly the area of tobacco use. Our public health is responsible for identifying and investigating those diseases, but our work is not done in isolation. We work with clinical providers who are very often the first person to identify the symptoms, send something off to the lab. Then we have to figure out, is this an isolated incident, or is this a bug that looks exactly like the bug that we heard about last week in another setting? And that's when we go into our outbreak investigations to see if there's transmission in a cluster. And this is done both with our clinical providers, our public health lab, our public health partners on the local level, and communities that are open and responsive to cooperating with these investigations in their own communities. So we've talked about our partnership in communicable disease, and when we talk about health promotion, chronic disease, and injury prevention, that is also completely dependent upon our cross-sectoral partnerships. The work includes how to identify healthy foods, how to make them more available to communities, increase opportunities for physical activity, and also, again, our policy work around tobacco-safe environments. Increasingly, public health is needed to understand more about what are the environmental impacts here in Oregon. Everyone knows that we kind of regulate restaurants, so the good news is you can basically eat anywhere in Oregon and order anything you want, and pretty sure you'll be able to go home and be healthy. Occasionally, that's not true. And again, we work both with the restaurant industry, with individual restaurants, as well as, you know, identifying what are some of the processes that lead to safe and healthy preparation and food in the commercial sector. And a lot of people here know I come from Multnomah County, and we're very proud of our food cart entrepreneurial support in Multnomah County years ago, and very, very proud of the fact that you can eat in all those food carts, and they're also inspected, and those chefs and staff get the same kind of coaching and technical assistance around safe preparation of food.
Senator Winter.
As a former restaurateur, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
How frequently are they inspected?
Well, these are all they're all done on the local level. So
that
local
I know, the counties does.
Right, the counties do that, and they're fee supported, and it depends locally. Sometimes it's twice a year, sometimes it's once a year, and I think the difference that has happened, the evolving understanding and of the practice, I think, is used to be kind of it was a stick. You know, you'd come in and say, you know, you didn't do this right, you didn't do that right. And much more now, it's kind of technical assistance and just saying, gee, you know, here's some of the things we're observing. And then, you know, the cooperation of the restaurants to have people who are certified, you know, food handlers, so that a lot of the preventive work happens because the industry has taken it upon themselves to get that education and to make sure that their staff understand proper food handling. So it's a real partnership between the regulatory side and then the practice of, say, food handling in the venues.
I'm thinking more of equipment and some of those when you're off-site versus that when you have a building and, you know, you don't worry as much about electrical shortages and refrigerations going down and those kinds of issues that you would when you're off-site.
It's definitely more difficult. It really is. So, again, that's why there has to be a partnership between the community of entrepreneurs and small businesses that have to deal with things like getting water and getting electricity, you know, having that consistency. Absolutely. It's a tough business.
I know.
So, when we talk about equitable access to health services, again, by design, we have a really strong partnership with CCOs and other providers. And one of the ways that we interface that's kind of behind the scenes is just identifying for practices and different areas, different CCOs, what we're seeing in the outcome data that they may want to have particular attention to the population of lives that they're covered in their area so that people can really know what to look for. One of our initiatives is this year, like with the communicable disease area as well as acquired infections, is letting people know, like, how many people in their patient panel, for instance, or in their particular covered lives section, what are the outcomes that we're seeing across for that neighborhood or that county, that CCO region, so that people can have an understanding of how to really have culturally appropriate as well as emphasis on what are the real health problems that is happening in that area of Oregon. And that's been a really it's been an innovative ability for public health and clinical to work together for particularly the most vulnerable people in our state. Okay. So back to that what do we mean when we say population health? This is a slide that is the closest thing we can come to Director Saxton's drawing on a whiteboard. Yeah. So, but when people think of public health, very often, because of the history before our transformation and before we've worked closer with the clinical systems and the insurers, people think of it as, you know, poor people's health care, you know, and the safety net. And more we're understanding that the best outcomes for people who need care is to be in a mainstream environment, whether it's a federally qualified health center or a Providence clinic, Providence Health Clinic. And what we see where public health has to look at is we're responsible for the 4 million of us, you know, that are here, and what are the threats to our health in the broader sense. So we focus on things like clean drinking water. And our vital records, which we've really improved, our IT systems have really improved in the last 2 or 3 years, because we've realized that we need real-time understanding and accurate information, because if we don't know who's in Oregon and where they are and what they died from and when they got born, you know, that's like the baseline for us understanding, you know, what is it that we need to do in Oregon as opposed to, you know, general national information about Iowa or Alabama. So it's really helped us to figure out how our resources need to be deployed. So a couple years ago, we undertook a state health improvement plan to really identify how is it that we are going to tie together these 100 programs in public health with all of the good work that's done in the healthcare sector, and really have a narrative that allows us to say this is what we need to aim for in our work here in Oregon. So our state health improvement plan, we came to these priorities through two ways. We both use the epidemiology of the state of Oregon, real Oregon data and trends that we're seeing in Oregon. So we were particularly interested in things that, you know, either the needle wasn't moving or we were going in the wrong direction. And then the second variable that we included was we went to communities and we asked community input, like what are the things in their community that they think that we should be tracking, identifying as priorities, and giving them feedback into how things are going. And this was the list that we came up with. So what we're trying to do is to look at not programs that specifically address going out to the one-on-one area, but if you look at the improved immunization rates, for instance, pretty soon I'm going to tell you we've improved in immunization rates. But it really two things. This body, the Oregon Legislature, 2 years ago passed a policy that said that if you have a non-medical reason, you just don't want to get your kids immunized. Well, you know, you have the freedom to do that in Oregon, but you have to look at an informational and educational video. And our providers, our pediatric providers, our primary care providers have really been really very cooperative in that. They've been doing that. And we've seen many people who've come in and said, oh, you know, I don't think I want to get my kids immunized. And if you ask them why, they say, well, I don't know, you know, because, you know, my neighbor didn't get her kids immunized or something. And then I say, okay, that's okay. It's up to you. But we want you to look at, like, what the choices are that you're making for your child. And it's really helped and increased the people who are agreeing to have their children immunized. And I think that's a basic example of real policy that can help across the board. So thank you for that. And go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Representative Lanzalea.
Yes, that's actually a really good topic because I spoke to a lot of families around their choice of whether they could immunize or not, and they appreciated having the choice, essentially. But do we have data on the families who chose not to get immunized, where their children are not immunized, and what impact it's made in our school system, for example?
So we could talk about that for the rest of the session. But the answer to your question is yes. You know, there are complexities. There's something called herd immunity. So there comes to this point where if we're all here and everybody has their children immunized and I don't, my child probably is not going to be at risk because we've gotten enough immunity across the system. So we really don't go for 100%, but we do know for all different communicable diseases have different thresholds of herd immunity. So we do know that and we do track it. We have seen recently, we've had some cases that mumps, for instance, that few cases of measles. We've had other cases where we're tracking. Some of these are imported. Come to our state from out outside of our state or outside of our country. And if we're immunized, the threat is really low to the children who are here. We track it very carefully. But I'm going to just ask Katrina if she's any more technical. So co-chairs and Representative Alonso León. Just as Director Shirley said, it's complicated. So certain diseases are more communicable. They are easier to spread. And so some diseases you need very high herd immunity. But we have done a number of studies which have shown, again, that cases, we tend to see them in clusters, including clusters of under immunized populations. So yes, it does make a difference. In some cases, what I'd like to say is we've been a victim of our own success because we have such good immunization rates overall in the United States in general that we don't see a lot of this giant outbreaks happening. And so it sometimes gets difficult to convince people that immunization is still important because, like I say, any one of these diseases is but a plane flight away from somewhere else that's either having an outbreak or has less immunization.
Thank you.
Are you going? You're going to say something.
Say it.
Chair.
I'm still got a little bit of PTSD from 2 years ago about this issue. One of the things we did 2 years ago was require schools to provide school-specific, disease-specific mm-hmm. immunization rate data to their families twice a year. Nice. I was at a big public event on Friday night and was approached by a parent saying, are you going to do it again this year to take away non-medical exemptions? And I'm like, no, I'm not. That's enough death threats already. But I said to her, well, because her daughter had leukemia, right? And so she couldn't get immunized for a while she was getting chemo and was very immunosuppressed, couldn't get her live virus vaccines, and she was very worried. And I said, well, you're supposed to be getting data from your school, and she said, I'm not. Mm-hmm. Now, I know we got it from our school, and I know Senator Gelser sent me the one that Corvallis sent out for their entire school system, which is great, but who's tracking that, you guys or Department of Education?
Good question.
It's on the website. We are not tracking it. I will be happy to see if Department of Education is actually tracking it.
Yeah, would you please? Yeah. Because having it on the website is great, but if parents don't know it's there, the whole point, I mean, it was already there. The question was, are we actually pushing it out to parents? Mm-hmm. Because they have the right to know. And it's helped, actually, at our school. Our immunization rates went up dramatically. With the new law and with notification, the parental notification. So, which is great.
We will definitely do that. It gives me an opportunity to just mention that in our efforts to have more, not just across OHA integration, but across state government, we now have a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Education that outlines specific areas that we're going to hold each other accountable for.
Great.
We have that with transportation and Metro. So this is the kind of work that we exactly want to see, that if we're all like rowing in the same direction and we can see how much progress we're making. So we will definitely look into that.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Co-chairs, if I might just add here, I think one of the things the health authority has been working on for the last 2 years is to reduce the number of reports and to reduce the size of the reports. All reports now require an executive summary so that you have access to information in a more efficient manner. The two reports that we are moving things into so that you don't get 40, 50 reports in a year is the State Health Improvement Plan, which is population health, and the action plan for health, which is the health policy that supports the coordinated care organizations and the coordinated care model. So increasingly, if you look at those two sources of information, you're getting the bulk of the data that is really critical for you to have as policymakers. And I just want to highlight that. We're not all the way to where we want to be, but we're moving in the direction of effectively using dashboards for performance and not giving you multiple reports on multiple issues throughout the year.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Just before we leave this slide, just two more points. One is every time there's the extent feasible, we are trying to make sure that the goals in the State Health Improvement Plan overall for the population align with the goals with the Coordinated Care Organization's incentive measures, so that we can see how that 1.1 group is contributing to the health of the 4.1, and moving that forward together. And then we will have very specific progress report for 2016, which is in, they're still crunching the numbers on how we're doing for all of these seven areas in the State Health Improvement Plan. And one example of this that of Director Saxton's point is we're seeing that as we get we look at obesity, and we're, like I said, we're going to talk a little bit more about that because it's a real problem, and we're not getting anywhere on it fast in the state. But what is it that we can do from policy, systems, and environment, pushing from the public health side, which is, our kind of overall bailiwick as opposed to the clinical issues of obesity. And what we've identified, looking at all of the interventions that are happening to get that, is we're really going to narrow down, there's 50 things you can do, and 25 of them have been evidence-based approved, but which are the where you get the biggest bang for your buck? And for instance, we're going to focus on just two areas to reduce obesity in the Oregon population, and one is walking, strategies to get people moving. And then the second, which is also evidence-based, that we've picked that shows a big return on investment, is nutrition standards. So we talk about healthy eating. We talk about there's 25 things we could talk about in both of those areas. But how do we just focus on for the next several years, 2 to 5 years, and see if we can see the results concretely by community, by different populations, by different age groups, and see if we can make a difference in that.
Because this is one of my favorite topics, and because, I started 5210 here in Salem, which, by the way, there's no public dollars involved. It's all community engaged, and it started from the bottom up, and it does deal with nutrition and exercise and unlimited amount of TVs, and we're actually working with our school districts in order to get kids more engaged and involved. And I understand that I just saw a note yesterday that Providence is talking about adding it to some of the things initiative that they're doing. Okay. But I also want to invite, and I'll get the date, all of you who are here, since you mentioned walking, we'll have a walk here at the Capitol in March. We've done it with legislators and others, so I'm inviting the panel to come join me for walking. But my question to you, can you, when you give your report, actually do the rates that exist in our 36 counties? Because I think, I started this when I knew how my county was. It was alarming, and so it kind of prompted me to say I needed to do more work in my own county.
Absolutely. And actually, we have a big initiative and that's been ongoing. And Katrina, Dr. Hedberg will talk about that, because we do have that data down to the county level. We would like to get it to the zip code level, but we only have it to
that. So, co-chairs and Representative Winters, one of the things that we also have on our website is what we call the State Health Profile, which is a whole set of public health indicators. I won't say they're not just public health. They're actually some of the social determinants, like education level, et cetera, and then they fall into buckets of leading causes of death and some behaviors, et cetera. To the extent possible, so there are about 70 indicators altogether, and to the extent possible, we have presented those by race, ethnicity, and also by CCO catchment area. Now, the issue around county, we would love to, and some of our indicators we can get down to the county level. Birth and death would be an example, because every person in those counties is actually counted. Some of our other data, like obesity or tobacco use, is done by a survey, a phone survey. In some of our smaller counties, we just don't, there aren't enough people who are sampled on the phone to get those. But we have been able to present those data by region, so we can get that for those.
Well, follow up, ma'am.
Sure.
Another comparison for me was, how do we compare nationally? And that's on all of your stats that you're presenting here in your document. How does Oregon rank? And I'm sure that you can probably get that to share with us with no real
problem. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, so co-chairs and Senator Winters, the answer is we rank across the board. Overall, I think we're now in America's health rankings, we're state number 23, I think. So that's a number that has actually gone down a little bit. But depending on what the specific area is, well, we either do quite well or we're not doing as well.
My interests are the categories, the seven that you identified as a part of your state health improvement plan. How do we in Oregon rank with the other 49 states? I mean, where are we and with obesity, and where are we tobacco use, and where are we when I look at my neighbor to the north or my neighbor to the south or just across the board? And that's my interest. And also communicable disease. It looks like that's the one that we're making improvement, but it doesn't look like that we are in the other categories.
Bueller, that dude, see, over there. You got me all confused. He started it.
Thank you, okay. Senator Rayfield. I think Senator Winters makes a really good point. I'd love to see how we compare, and then maybe to take it one step further, and what's your three-year and five-year goal on that? So we can.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And it'd be great, I know this is a prior reach too far right now, to have this tie then to the regional health improvement plans of the CCOs, right, to influence those plans maybe with these state priorities that they all kind of tie up together. But that wasn't actually what I was going to ask.
Okay, well, you can ask
another. Senator Winters just got me going there.
You can ask another question then, Representative Bueller.
The state of Maine, and I think a few others, have been pushing on the Department of Agriculture to limit the use of SNAP funds to buy junk food like candy and high sugar
federal drugs.
Would you be willing to sign on to that effort of other states to support legislation at the federal level to change that policy?
So I'm going to go out on a limb here. I work for Director Sexton and the governor. So, but as a public health professional, yes, we have some information that we actually can present to you. I think it got edited out, but we actually know, like, what are the percentages of consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages, et cetera. We've looked at all of that. It's a complex issue. There have been discussions in the state of Oregon around these issues. It's a complex issue because we want to make sure that we're not having policy that blames the victims, you know, or treats one category of our population different than other categories of our population. So a lot of debate in the state of New York, you're absolutely right, and a lot of debate in the state of Maine, and our particularly our WIC staff have been engaged with that work, which also cuts over into the Oregon Hunger Task Force work. So we can definitely prepare a brief for you.
Okay.
So how you'd be a victim to it because you couldn't take federal money to buy candy. It's a reach for me.
There are different perspectives on that.
Maybe we need some policy direction.
Representative Rayfield had a question, and Senator Winters had another question. Although, if you want to say something else about this specific topic, Dr. Hedberg, please feel free.
So, Co-Chair,
I'm trying to serve the traffic controller.
our current, we have actually looked at not all, if you will, junk food together, but specifically sugar-sweetened beverage consumption, and we actually, so we can get you some data on that, but that luckily has been going down, especially in youth and very young. So that's a one specific area where we're tracking consumption of a particular product, so that would be sugar-sweetened beverage. So we are making some headway with the current strategy. It's a little bit different than what you asked about, whether federal funds or should be used for to pay for.
Representative
Yeah. I know some insurance companies aggregate claims and recognize actually health trends and things like that. Do you guys have access to that type of data where they can actually get into specific geographic locations and say, hey, we're seeing, you know, a certain health condition in this area. Oh, that pairs up with, you know, an environmental condition in that area. You guys are talking about surveys, but insurance companies actually have real data. Mm-hmm. Is that type of cooperation going on, or are there barriers to increasing that cooperation?
So, co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Rayfield, yes, we not only do we have access to that data, but the opportunity Oregon has by having public health and Medicaid health in one agency is our health policy team regularly tracks all the national kind of insurance looks at what's driving health. The Kaiser Foundation does some of this work. United Health does some of this work. There's a bunch of. I think the piece about looking at the overlay of the CCO catchment areas and the public health information, I think that's something our health policy team and our public health division can collaborate and get a finer read of what they're seeing and what the opportunities are for solutions. I think that's a great suggestion. So, yes, we have the data. Yes, we track it. And, yes, we have more work to do to integrate what we're seeing on the Medicaid side with what we're seeing on the public health side. The best data, although we have the CCO metrics, which are obviously really helpful, but the best, it's probably about the end of March that we're going to have the best data from our Medicaid enrollment eligibility process and can begin that work. But that was part of the original vision when the two agencies were put in one place is to go back and forth with the analytics and drive to better outcomes overall.
Just a quick follow-up.
Sure.
To the extent that you can dig down, can you actually get into geographic areas and be able to easily look at that? I'm just seeing the head shaking.
Well, easily, I don't think. Representative, I'm going to be really honest here. You know,
can you come into my neighborhood and tell me who's healthy and not?
Well, I don't know if you want us doing that, but we can't. To Director Saxon's point, Oregon does is one of the states with an all-payer, all-claims database, and we are actually just in the process of having the Public Health Division analysis move over in Health Analytics to work on that. We have done these CCO regions with the population. We've done that. I'm just kind of it isn't easy, and there are, but we do have a commitment to do it. And again, you know, just, you know, when I started, I said, here's some of the things that we've been doing since 2016. I think that's true, and even in our rankings, you know, when we look at the rankings, we had some slippage in some of our areas, and when we looked into it, well, what was going on here? Well, it turns out that one of the national indicators had taken high school graduation rates, and they had put it into how well are you doing in public health. You know, so it's like, and before that wasn't there, you know. So, I mean, we're really trying to understand where are the areas that we can really influence and to do more of this cross-state government, cross-sector work to really get everybody, you know, working on the outcomes that we know we need to agree on.
Just
so,
let's follow up real quick, because I just have a real specific question. In talking with local public health departments, how, you know, obviously having specific data about your community, not necessarily CCO-wide regions, but within your community when you're looking at environmental issues and other factors like that, how specifically can you dig down currently with the data that you have? So can you get down to, you know, citywide, neighborhood-wide, or what does that allow you to do currently?
So from the state level, neighborhood-wide, no.
Okay.
That was my point about we'd like to get zip code data. But
okay, yeah. But
in terms of talking to local public health departments, this gets back to a comment Representative Rayfield that Representative Buehler made. We we are looking at, and we do have work that we've done. All the county health departments have had to do a health improvement plan in the same way that the hospitals have had to do that for their tax, you know, their assessment for their the not-for-profit hospitals. Then we have the CCO's assessment and health improvement plan. And what we've worked on in public health is actually a matrix showing everybody, you know, across the state, all these different assessments as well as the improvement plans, what are people coming up with in their local areas for their top priorities. And reflected, actually, in our top seven here reflects that work, where if a community identified these three areas, your local health department assessment, which they have to do for accreditation. So just in the last 4 years, there's been a tremendous amount of data collected in a better and organized way for us to understand what's going on community by community. And your question about cities, we don't have that capacity here, but they're just literally this week, there was launched a big cities data initiative, which includes the one, this is a national effort, it includes the 100 largest cities in the United States. And in our state, Beaverton, Gresham, Medford, Bend, as well as we always think of Portland, but there's a number of cities that are included in this database that local cities can actually see all these indicators as they're comparative across the nation, but also very specific to their you know, governmental jurisdiction as opposed to the wider county as opposed to the state. So we're hoping to be able to use a lot of our ability in terms of technical assistance and what can we provide at the state level, getting people to understand what's out there, number one. Number two, how to use it and how to analyze what it means, and to make sure that a lot of the data that Dr. Hedberg talked about in our state health profiles, a lot of nonprofits use it, a lot of city planners use it, you know, I mean, making it a resource across sectors for what should we be prioritizing in our area. Do we have a long way to go? Yes. You know,
Insurance companies can actually dig a little bit more, and they're using that data in a very innovative way. There's a long way for us to go, it sounds like.
Exactly. Well, yeah. I just want to put a little bit of a discipline on the data discussion. That we have 4 million people in this state. We're not a huge state. You know, Washington State has 7 million plus. California's, you know, the sixth largest economy in the world. And part of what we're putting a real emphasis on in the agency, and Dr. John Collins, who leads our data look at in health policy, is to really force the analytics into one room with concrete proposals for improvements. Because frankly, particularly with regard to children's well-being, if we figure out something 10 years from now, we've missed a lot of kids who are growing up right now, and we need to know what the gaps are and what their needs are so that we can get on it. So I think what we see in the modernization effort and the accreditation of counties and the data we have from counties, the data we have from the CCOs, the data we have from our own Medicaid eligibility work, you know, particularly over the last year, is what we're looking to do for the seven things in the state health improvement plan and the goals of the action plan for health, is to take what we know right now, make it actionable, and set goals for ourselves for improvement in the near term. Even in the behavioral health collaborative, we forced ourselves to think in 2-year increments, because I love data as much as the next person. I think you have to be really careful not to be questing for perfect data, and when we know everything about everyone, you have to keep in mind the size of the state and the need to move forward in the near term. So increasingly, our agency is going to be getting everyone in the same room together with their data sets and saying, what is it that's actionable now? What is it that needs to be done in the near term while we're getting to broader concepts and better data.
And Can I just,
please?
So co-chairs. So just the way I think about data, and I'm very happy that everyone is so interested in sort of, we have data, as I mentioned, on individuals when it comes to vital records. So everybody who's born, and we have an address, everybody who dies in the state. So that we actually have very granular data. Everyone who gets diagnosed with a reportable disease in Oregon, so that's some of the infectious diseases. We know where they live. Some of the things like obesity, we don't have an obesity registry. So these data come from surveys. Well, is that or a registry of smokers? I mean, so depending, and then sort of the third case. So we do have survey data, we have reportable disease, vital records, and then the other large bucket, if you will, of data are these health service data. So again, we talked a little bit about that immunization. We do have a registry. That's a health service that we track in public health. All of the data that we were talking about, CCOs or insurance data, again, the all-peril claims, we have some access to that. But again, within some of those, they might have a very specific diagnosis code. They don't necessarily have the risk behaviors that we might be asking about. So the answer to your question is, yes, we can do it for some, not for others. But for all of it that we can do, again, as Director Saxton also said, lots and lots of data. And at some point, we have to say, okay, there's enough. We see, for example, obesity that's up here now is going in the wrong direction or it's leveled off. This may be enough to know whether certain areas of the state it's less of a problem and others more. I can tell you this is a problem across the board for Oregon, even if there's some areas that are slightly higher or lower.
Okay. Yes. Senator Winters.
I'm going to change the subject. I'm not going to ask you about data. But, you know, I'm going to go back to the question that was raised by Representative Buehler, and that's on SNAP. And my question is, and I'm making the assumption that you do belong to some of the national public health and attend some of those conferences, where there are roundtable discussions that occur on various issues that relate to public health. And does this provide you with an opportunity to bring this issue, because it's not just Oregon, and those forums sometimes can be a way of having those discussions. And I recognize that, Department of Ag is it's federal in nature. It is the Department of Ag, but I do know that before Dr. Goldberg left, he and I were talking to regionally to the regional office with Ag to see if we could not begin to start having these discussions on this particular issue. And I just wanted to know if you have that opportunity to begin doing some of that discussion nationally.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, yes, we do participate in and we do take advantage of what we're learning from other states, what's working across the nation, what isn't working across the nation, and try and, you know, figure out what would work for here. And back to Director Saxton's point, what are the issues that are really much more salient for our population here in Oregon?
Follow up. If obesity is really a serious issue for us, and, I know that the senator, the good Senator Steiner, Hayward and good Senator Gelton, I'm sure some of the House members, and I belong to national groups. Those groups are opportunities, and I'm just asking, they're opportunities to express those issues and get support for those issues that we all have common, because it is common across, for us. We don't operate in isolation, because often what's happening in Oregon is also happening in Minnesota and other places across the country. And so we use those platforms in order to help us to dealing with those federal issues. Mm-hmm. And that was my question, if you could also use that platform when you go to your national meetings.
Let me just say that I think this question of could we use SNAP dollars in a directive way to preclude purchasing foods and beverages that are adverse to people's health. If you would like us to bring a proposal back to you to how to do that differently in Oregon than we currently do it, we'd be happy to do that.
Well, I'd like to see it not just Oregon, because these forums are national in scope.
I think we currently participate in many forums. We share our data, we share our knowledge, our wisdom. I think the question is,
could we do something concrete based on our national exposure to what other states are working? I think I'd like to look at that and hear from the public health department what are the advances other states have made. So let us bring that back to you.
Thank you. That would be lovely.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
Okay. Quick, Representative Hayden.
Quick comment on that. Thank you, co-chairs. On that subject, we've increased the bottle bill. We all see fraud and abuse stories in the newspaper. We also see statistics that those are small when it comes to the SNAP benefits. Would there be a possibility to limit, let's say, bulk purchases of products that have a refundable amount, say a case of water, 24 bottles is worth $2.40 cash starting in April, and if we have SNAP benefits, buying those at pallet at a time to convert to cash, there's a stronger incentive now. There's a double incentive starting April 1st than there was before. Would it be legitimate to look at some reasonable, people should certainly buy water, right? But it would it be reasonable to put some limits on the amount of purchase at a time?
Co-chairs, Representative Hayden, I'd like to get some information on that. I think I'd like to do some research. Would it be reasonable? Yes. I think what I don't think we have done is, and tell me if I'm wrong, I don't think we've looked at what's currently happening in Oregon, what's currently working in other states, the change in the bottle bill reimbursement rate. And I think what we'd like to do is go do our homework and come back to you with something that we think makes sense.
There's an easier way to deal with that. You just make people buy, not the bottle deposit, not be a EBT benefit. And that would solve that problem without having to measure how much people are buying. Because frankly, there are some people who get Oregon Trail SNAP benefits who don't live in places with decent water and, you know, where there's lead issues. I mean, we know we have that in the Portland metro area, and they have to buy bottled water. So we need to make sure that we're not precluding them from getting water that saves their families. So the easier way to deal with that probably is just not include the bottle deposit on the EBT benefit.
Agreed from a functional standpoint and an accounting standpoint, but maybe from a political standpoint that might be difficult.
I don't know. Okay, we are almost out of time, and I think maybe it's not a bad place to break because we've talked about this slide. I'm going to take the liberty of making the last point and that I want my colleagues to be aware of. You will notice that we hold the public health department accountable as a key performance measure for obesity rates. We hold them accountable for tobacco use rates, which are pretty substantial things to hold the department accountable for. Whereas yesterday, when we saw PEB and OWEB, they were just held accountable for, do people think they're doing a good job? Do their beneficiaries think they're doing a good job? Now, frankly, I think KPMs are more appropriate like this, and that's a conversation that we will be having with our colleagues at PEB and OWEB, and I want to commend the Department of Public Health for being willing to take on such aggressive and difficult KPMs and making such good progress in some of the areas. So I just thought I'd point that out as a way perhaps to close. Any final words for today, ladies?
See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow. Okay. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, hearing this.